This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the March 1988 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is The Toll Bridge by Harvey Jacobs. Dr. Maxfield Schnibitz was no slave to a single discipline. He described his work as eclectic. He refused to be classified as a Freudian, Jungian, or Reichian, or any Ian. He once told a seminar on Directions in Psychiatry, The New Age, "The modern analyst must be a bridge between the secular and spiritual worlds, albeit a toll bridge." Dr. Schnibitz, a stocky man with a large, round head, bald at the top, a bush of a mustache, sideburns that flared, and a compassionate face, then leaned intimately towards his audience and said, "And while the tolls may be generous, they take a toll, dealing with the anguished, the off-center, even the mildly troubled was exhausting, and Dr. Schnibitz did not feel overpaid. His reward was not all monetary, of course. Occasionally, he helped a patient achieve a breakthrough, and he played midwife to the birth of a restructured soul. He had been catalyst for amazing change, and those patients who were fortunate enough to shed burdens of fuzzy guilt for a fresh, positive outlook were obviously grateful. Sometimes they gave him presents. Such was the case with a man who came in a basket case and climbed successfully from his basket after years of turmoil. During his final session, he handed Dr. Schnibitz an amulet on a gold chain. "I actually bought this thing from a psychic in Albania," the cured man said. "That's a measure of how bad off I was. She told me it was a power symbol that once belonged to a werewolf or some damn thing that went broke and pawned it. That was before the country went commie. She's probably the Minister of Culture now." Dr. Schnibitz accepted the gift without commenting on the symbolic overtones. The redeemed patient was handing his doctor something he himself had redeemed, an amulet that linked him to magic, the uncontrolled kingdom of shadows, the dark forces of madness, no longer a threat. He was handing his bit of ersatz power to the man powerful enough to overcome those demons. Dr. Schnibitz just smiled from his ample face and shook hands with his departing patient. It was the first time they had ever touched physically, and it satisfied the psychiatrist that the hand he gripped was dry, the handshake firm and confident. The amulet was put in a desk drawer. That night, after finishing with his caseload, Dr. Schnibitz was filled with a strange curiosity about the object. He took it out of the drawer and laid it on his desk. It was shaped like a pyramid and made from some amalgam of stone, metal, and bone. His fingers brushed over it. There was a porous quality, slightly gritty, like stroking a dry sponge. God knows what it was made of, or when, or why. A friend of Dr. Schnibitz brought back an amulet from Africa, formed of rag and wood chips that turned out to be home to a devilish larva. Worms infested the poor man's apartment. They had to be bombed by exterminator using chemicals that made the place smell like a toxic dump. The amulet on Dr. Schnibitz's desk did not seem like it would harbor anything organic. It felt cold, lifeless. He decided it was no hive or nest. Besides, the patient had worn it for years. Curiously, it was never mentioned during their hundreds of sessions. Had it been, the timetable of discovery and recovery might have been quickened. Treasured objects often mirror the most secret images. They can be valuable shortcuts to the core of an affection. Perhaps that is why they are so defended. Dr. Schnibbetz was hurt that his patient had never spoken of the amulet, and he laughed alone in his office to find himself reacting like a child. It was, as they say, water under the bridge. More interesting was the fact that the patient had actually purchased such a talisman. The man ran a successful business, was married, had children. For all his problem, he was a creature of this scientific century. Yet he paid American dollars for something he knew to be worthless. Maybe that was the motivation, a shared sense of worthlessness. Or was it simple, old-fashioned desperation? What had Nixon's daughter said to the press? Never underestimate the power of fear. Well, the patient was no longer a patient, no longer troubled, a closed file. Dr. Schnibbetz wished he could say the same about himself. In recent months, he had felt a growing dissatisfaction with his own life. He found himself angry at patients who complained of things that were no more than the ordinary viruses of life. He was bored by transparent dreams and frustrated ambitions that never were worth the achieving. Dr. Schnibbetz suspected his own burnout. He needed a vacation, a change, but he could think of no place he wanted to go, nothing he wanted to see. Stroking the amulet, his mind wandered to exotic places on the globe: Marrakesh, Tahiti, the Isles of Greece, Kyoto, and rejected them one by one. No, it was not a vacation he needed. It was some kind of challenge. He knew that the patient who would replace the patient who left would come trembling with doubt, armed against ghosts that would prove to be made from curds of milk from some denying tit, that he would have to listen to hours and hours of the same old crap, the moaning and groaning, the evasions and denials, and finally, with luck, confrontation and rejoicing. Another triumph, another little gift, and on and on and on. The truth about people is that they are often duller than dishwater. Dishwater is a complex swirl about to confront the ultimate drain. Most neurotics confront nothing more than their own borders. Perspective sets them free. They leave satisfied with their limitations. They find strength in the acceptance of weakness. And often they grow arrogant with their new identity as blades of grass, not towering trees, on the human landscape. With that knowledge, they go on to intimidate other neurotics, and so on and on and on. Dr. Schnibbetz let out a long, loud sigh. He remembered the case of a secretary who was terrified when she thought of all the papers she would type over a lifetime. She saw them as an Everest of papers. She had been saved with the insight that she would type the pages one at a time. That was enough to liberate her from nightmares. Actually, it should have caused worse nightmares for the poor woman, but she became a more efficient secretary, eventually an office manager, then a vice president, and she still sent a card every Christmas. She also referred patients. Sick transit. A challenge, enormous challenge, combat. Maybe that would open arteries clogged with predictability and send a rush of blood to the large eggplant brain under Dr. Schnibbetz's bald pate. The doctor found himself tapping at his skull. He also found himself sucking the amulet like a lollipop. Sometimes during his meditations, he had unconsciously put the trinket into his mouth. It was his first unconscious gesture in years. He marveled while he tongued at the weird thing, the gold chain dangling from his lips like dribble, and he thought, maybe it is time for the travel folders. There was a loud noise in Dr. Schnibbitz's reception room. He jumped. His own secretary had left early to make a theater curtain. There were no arrivals scheduled. The building had experienced several burglaries despite a good security system, and Dr. Schnibbitz realized that he might become a statistic. The evening news might carry pictures of his dead body. There was somebody out there, no question. He could hear sounds of an intruder, even hard breathing. Some of his colleagues carried guns, had cans of mace, warned him to be prepared. Theirs was a hazardous profession at best, but Dr. Schnibbitz was a peaceable man who called himself a black belt conversationalist. His conceit was that he could negotiate himself out of any danger. At that moment, he wasn't so sure. Suppose the thief were drugged beyond the spell of spoken word. Bang, it would be over. He would cease to exist as a man and become a scholarship, a memory, a collection of papers stored in a university library. He plucked the amulet from his mouth. How would the police interpret that? It would send them after some voodoo cult in Brooklyn. To remain silent was the wrong tack. Better to announce his presence. That would be enough to frighten most petty criminals, and whoever it was would find his way into the consulting room anyhow. Dr. Schnibbitz said in a strong voice, "Yes, who is it? Who are you, and what do you want?" The response was a guttural gurgle, mingled with a growl. It was not a person out there, no felon. It was an animal, a beast, a predator. Dr. Schnibbitz felt an old fear, the kind he once knew in the pitch dark of his parents' beach house on Cape Cod, when the ocean seemed to lick at the windows. Well, he had learned to cope with that kind of terror. He took deep, slow breaths, moving quietly towards the thick office door. He flipped the lock, heard the bolt set. Whatever was out there would not have an easy time getting in. Dr. Schnibbitz ran for his telephone. There was not time to dial. The consultation room door disintegrated. It splintered and fell apart. Holding the phone, paralyzed with sheer amazement, Dr. Schnibbitz saw what was standing there, looking in at him. It was only a shape at first, like a fog bank, like steam spitting from a sewer grate. Then it crystallized. Dr. Schnibbitz put down the telephone. A man watched. The shape became a man. A man with horns. No, a man wearing a helmet that sprouted horns. A man with a bull's head. No, the face was human, mustached, bearded with a prow for a nose and enormous blue eyes, and the neck, thick as a thigh, a pedestal. The body, a chunk, a rock covered in furs, black fur, brown fur, white fur. Braceleted arms, poles with gold rings, hanging ape-like from the trunk, bare legs dangling, stubby legs heavy and muscled, the feet protected by boots made from russet leather skins. The man grunted at Dr. Schnibbitz, but made no move. Instinctively, Dr. Schnibbitz positioned himself beside his formidable desk. He sat in his chair, keeping control, aware that he fused with the desk, became a centaur with a mahogany frame. He knew the effect of that combination on even the most disturbed patients. It calmed them to be in such a presence. "You have no appointment," Dr. Schnibbitz said. Leave now. Call my secretary, Ms. Rosen, in the morning. She'll give you a proper time. The visitor came forward and paused at the Eames chair where new patients sat outlining their misery. Great hands fondled the chair, then grabbed it up off its base and cracked it in two. The hands lifted the metal base and twisted at it. The metal bent and finally fractured. Impressive, said Dr. Schnibbets, but hardly sensible. You're going to be billed for damages. I suggest you restrain yourself. We both know you're strong. Now, tell me what you want here. I am Attila.
The Hun?
Of course, the Hun. Your fixation is that you are Attila the Hun?
No fixation. It's who I am. The damned, accursed, bloodthirsty son of a bitch Teuton who terrorized the civilized world and ate babies for dessert.
Very well. I am Dr. Maxfield Schnibbets.
Jesus, I know that much.
Then we have the basis for communication.
Possibly. But don't be smug. Don't give me that shit about calling for an appointment.
If you rub me the wrong way, I will straggle you with your own intestines.
You feel aggressive?
I always feel aggressive.
I am aggressive.
You called me to come and kill you. The only reason I hate is curiosity, and I am in no hurry to return to hell.
I called you to come and kill me?
You sucked the amulet, wishing for death.
I did not suck the amulet. I did insert it into my mouth in a purely unconscious gesture. But I was not wishing for death.
You certainly were. I don't know your exact thoughts, something about boredom and challenge, but it added up to a definite death wish.
Yes, I can see how you might have interpreted it that way.
I do see that.
You come from hell?
I did.
And you want to know what kind of a place it is?
Terrible. At first I enjoyed it. They had clever tortures, interesting agonies. But after centuries, repetition replaces surprise, and that is the worst torture.
You feel tortured?
I am tortured by professionals, corporate professionals, with amoebic imagination. When I am called back by the amulet, I welcome the change. But I can't stay too long. They sulk. That is beyond endurance. So I will kill you now in the most amusing way possible. Would you like to be skinned alive?
Broiled?
What?
Give me some guidance.
Attila, if I may. And you call me Maxfield. Forget the doctor. If I did wish for death in my deepest unconscious, then that was a regressive, immature response to the curious mix of triumph and frustration at turning a patient loose. I do become involved with my patients. I don't want to die just yet, but thank you for making a prompt house call.
I came for nothing? For nothing?
Attila began to wring his hands. Dr. Schnibbets saw the neck bulge, the face turn purple.
You want to break something?
I think I do. Yes. No. No. I don't want to break anything. I came to grant your wish, not dismantle your office.
And you handle frustration in a most predictable way. Smash, burn, loop, ray, crow. That's what you want. Admit it.
I admit it. Big news. Patients pay you for such insight?
Snide remarks now. More anger.
Perhaps your trip was not a total loss.
I came to kill you. Now you tell me you want to live.
I came to do you a favor. You spurn my gesture. That's what I call a total loss.
I haven't heard bones crunch in God knows how long. God, you said God knows how long. I know what I said. Strange, coming from Attila the Hun. Talk of God. Tell me, do you think about God very often? Absolutely not. It was only an expression. Do you regret renouncing your place in heaven? I assume there must be a heaven if you say you live in hell. Certainly there is a heaven. I never thought much about it. My renunciation was made in the equivalent of kindergarten. I chose a lifestyle that mandated a death style. You must question the choice from time to time. Not really, sometimes, but negative thinking is a waste of time and energy. Negative thinking? Don't you mean positive thinking? Did I say negative? I meant positive. You must ask yourself if heaven is better. You've never seen my rap sheet. In one lifetime, I accomplished more than 1,000 mafias, 12 Hitlers, 50 Vlad Tepeses. My own Dobermans were afraid of me. I shed more blood than the American Medical Association. Heaven is a place I will never visit. If I were to come within 1,000,000 leagues of heaven, angels would throw up on me. No, Maxfield, I don't think much about heaven as a viable alternative. Let me kill you. You go to heaven. See for yourself. I'll crush your skull between your own feet. Nice deadlines. Prime time coverage. I'll rip off your ears. Just suppose, Attila, that you were to renounce your past life and ask forgiveness. Some are beyond redemption, as the phrase goes. Suppose, just suppose, that you could prove that your antisocial behavior was no fault of your own. That would make some difference. If I were a victim, well, they can appreciate that. It makes them feel guilty, as if they were conspirators, as if they failed. But in my case, a clear choice was made. I loved evil from my first breath. I bit my mother's nipples just for the hell of it. No, Maxfield, I couldn't mount any kind of defense. I could never earn gray time. Gray time? The chance to live again. Make up for past indignities. If you can get them to grant an appeal, it is possible to earn a certain period of gray time. Return to life? Naturally. Do good deeds. Tell ugly women they are beautiful. Cross cripples. Sympathize with the blind. Comfort the losers. Like that. Don't you watch television? They do that plot to death. Fascinating. Why not sit down on the couch and tell me about it? Better, lie down, relax. I don't have all night. Suppose I peel back your lips and leave your skull exposed, or unravel your navel, or split your buttocks. You could have an interesting and provocative demise. You'd be the first topic of conversation tomorrow morning. They might even remember until evening. What do you say? We'll decide about that later. Make yourself comfortable. Attila bellowed a sigh. Dr. Schniblitz remembered his own recent sigh. He looked down at the amulet, still damp, draped over his appointment calendar. Talk about a challenge to tempt the humanity in Attila the Hun, to give gray time to the deathmonger maniac swear by. It would be a feather in my psychoanalyst's cap. Freud himself would give me a testicle for the chance. Dr. Schniblitz watched his guest test the naugahyde couch. Attila sat, suddenly reclined. Without thinking, Dr. Schniblitz slipped a paper doily under Attila's enormous head. What for? Disposable. Ah. So you nipped at your mother's nipple just to see her reaction?
Yes, I did.
Nice woman, deserved better. And were you punished?
Harsh words, the usual. My father was the enforcer. When they first put me on the pot, he would make me sit for hours.
You had a difficult toilet training.
Not difficult, firm. Father was a disciplinarian. A nasty old bastard, drank fermented goat's milk.
And when he got drunk?
Behaved like a slob.
And you attacked a source of milk, your mother's breasts.
Are you suggesting that I was actually attacking my father?
You said that, not I.
Funny about that. When I ordered all non-virgins in Gaul to be eviscerated on the shortest day of the year, I had a dream about bosoms that looked like fountains. In fact, I ordered fountains that looked like bosoms for my castle in the mountains, the snow-capped mountains.
You ordered non-virgins eviscerated on the shortest day of the year?
You're not suggesting that my first act of political violence was rooted in concern about the size of my phallus?
You said it. Rooted. Your words. Fountain bosoms. Snow-capped mountains.
Mom?
Possibly.
But why would I associate my mother with concerns about the length of
why?
Why indeed?
It's just possible that
Attila, jackknifed, stood, slammed his fist into the wall. Dr. Schnibbetz had seen all that before.
I've got to get back. If you want to go on living, fine. That's your problem. But I'm expected for skewering.
Wait just a minute. How can I best put this? Don't be so hard on yourself. Boys will be boys. Mothers are often the objects of desire, possessiveness. It isn't uncommon for a male child to feel inferior comparing his penis to his father's.
Inferior? I never felt inferior. Didn't I build the tallest obelisk outside Egypt, just outside my wading pool?
You built an obelisk outside your wading pool?
Well, yes, I did, to commemorate the sack of Rome, or was it Constantinople?
An obelisk, a wading pond.
Now, tell me I sacked whatever it was I sacked just for an excuse to build an obelisk to prove I had an impressive organ to a wading pool. Come on, Maxfield.
What were you doing with a wading pool?
I enjoyed wading. It was a nice round pool surrounded by pines.
Wading, or waiting, a nice round wet pool surrounded by pines?
Oh, now, cut it out, not Mom. If I accept all that, you could say every single act of vicious abandon I ever perpetrated was nothing but a charade to conceal a hidden desire to,
you said it, I didn't.
You know how to make a fellow feel cheap.
Attila began to cry. He rose from the couch and stared into a mirror on the far wall. That mirror had seen many, many such broken faces. Dr. Schnibbetz came and put his arm around the hulking, sulking hulk. If you were a victim of an innocent childhood obsession, surely you don't deserve eternal damnation.
Grounds for an appeal? Me?
Why not?
Maxfield, do you begin to realize what you've done for me?
All in a day's work. Sit and rest. Have yourself a glass of water. There's plenty in the pitcher on my desk.
I feel wasted, empty, naked, reborn.
While Attila sipped ice water, Dr. Schniblitz, elated, went to the outer office. He found a key in his pocket and opened a closet marked private. The closet had not been opened in years. It had a musty smell. Dr. Schniblitz undressed to his underwear. From the closet, he took a fur coat that had once belonged to his wife. It was repossessed during a nasty divorce settlement. He put on the coat, then a helmet crowned with the antlers of an 8-point buck, the gift of a saved bank president. A pair of sandals replaced his shoes, though he kept on his long socks because of a chill in the air. At the back of the closet, near a set of golf clubs, he found a sword and shield. He had bought them at the auction of an old woman's estate for no special reason beyond irony. Ready, he came back into his consulting room and stood with his legs wide apart. The sniveling mass on his couch sipped water and moaned while he beat his chest with a limp fist. "Stand up and fight," Dr. Schniblitz yelled, waving the sword over his head. Attila looked up at him with watery eyes. The Hun only shrugged. "Do battle, barbarian," said Dr. Schniblitz. The Hun's eyes were blank. "I demand you to defend yourself." Dr. Schniblitz leapt across the oriental rug and sank home his sword just under the thick neck. He felt very good, elated, ready to take on a multitude of neurotics. He made a mental note to send his former patient a brief thank you note. We continue with a story from the October 1987 issue of the magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Drummer's Star by Edward Bryant. It looked like curtains for scorched earth after Bobby T. got hit in the mouth with an empty Lone Star bottle right during the encore of the second set. The boys called it an encore, even though none of the rednecks guzzling down the suds and harder stuff really wanted to listen. But the guys had some pride. Encore it was. First, a weird up-tempo medley of Sally Go Round the Roses and 96 Tears. Then, the absolute drag down of Wisconsin Death Trap. I always tell them to reverse the order. They never listen. Death Trap is a terrific song, one of Scorched Earth's really good originals, but the gut-level dirge of the bass and Kenny Bach's nasal whine of a vocal line didn't get a whole lot of acceptance from the tipsy crowd. What it got was our drummer in the hospital with glass cuts, a jaw busted in two places, and 7 missing teeth. Son of a bitch with the bottle should pitch for the Mets. The clientele of the Dillo Patch couldn't have cared less after the music ground to a halt. They were too busy wailing on each other with fists, pool cues, and more bottles. Looked like the scenes in westerns where they bust up the saloon, except here, guys tended to stay down when they were slugged, and the blood looked a lot messier. Cotter and Peach were helping Bobby T. out from behind his kit and down off the shaky riser that served as a bandstand when Kenny numbly dragged up to me, holding his Stratocaster by the neck, and said, "Rusty, man, get us the hell out of here. I think Bobby's really hurt." Well, Bobby was, of course. A couple of guys from the club who didn't look like they wanted to wade into the fighting on the dance floor helped hustle him out of the Dillo Patch and
across town to the hospital and the only ER. The intern on duty did his best to patch Bobby up, gave him a big shot of painkiller, and said Bobby T. have to stay at least overnight to be observed for possible concussion. So, that was that. The drummer in the hospital, and another day of contract left. Contracts don't grow on trees, especially not in sleazoid clubs in tiny towns out in the less traveled boonies of West Texas. Bobby drifted off with his mouth all wrapped in bloody gauze. It looked like he'd have the comfortable bed for the night. I took the boys back to the Motel 6 and put them all to bed. Me? I couldn't sleep, and so I took a walk. It was late enough that the single traffic light in the center of town was switched off its cycle and just blinked red in two directions, amber in the other two. The pickup drivers didn't seem to pay much mind. The bars were letting out, and I suspected the local cops were cooping it until the noise died down. Walking at a right angle to the main drag, it didn't take me long to get to the edge of town. It wasn't like being on any of the coasts, east, west, or even the Gulf. I just had to cross a final, haphazardly graveled street, get to the other side of a narrow field, and then there I was, climbing a low sand hill and looking back at the sparse lights of town. One thing about being in the middle of nowhere. At least there wasn't a lot of crap in the air to spoil the night. I looked up and saw the Milky Way banding the sky. Looked kind of like a belt of air pollution, only prettier. I sat down on the rock and watched the stars twinkle for a while. I counted 3 falling stars in about as many minutes. Not bad at all. I've always loved the sky at night, even when I've been in the middle of cities. There's a challenge in trying to find stars through the dome of light and the cloud layers. "It is very beautiful," said a voice from right behind my left shoulder. I jumped. "Who the hell are you?" "I was at the Dillo Patch when the trouble started. I enjoyed the music very much." I cocked my head and tried to focus on the guy. All I could make out in the darkness was just his outline. He could have been anybody. "Hell of a finish," I said. "Is your drummer badly injured?" "Nothing to shout about," I said. "I expect he'll get out tomorrow or maybe the next day, but he's not going to be hitting the skins very soon. Fingers are fine, but I think his head'll beat to a rhythm of its own for a while." "That's too bad." "Sure as shit is," I said. Me sitting, him standing. We both stayed quiet for a while. Finally, he said, "Maybe I could help you out." "Yeah. You have to play again soon, right?" "Tomorrow night." "At home, I have played the drums," said the man. "Rock and roll?" "Something very like that." "May not be close enough," I said. "You were there. You heard them. We're talking hot." "Try me," he said. "Okay. You show up tomorrow at the bar. Give me the morning to sleep in and check on Bobby T. Come round about 2. I will be there." "You're sure you can play?" My words just sort of spilled out into the night and lay there. There was nobody else on the hilltop with me. Road managing scorched earth is just a little something I'm doing to kill time until a major project starts up. Sure, that's what I tell myself. The truth is, the guys are about the only gig I can land right now. I've been pretty good about preserving what's left of the inside of my nose. I mean, I've been clean for better than 2 years, but it doesn't seem to mean spit to the groups I used to work with. Not bitter, not me. No, sir. except on Saturdays, and this was Saturday. 2 o'clock, I sat there in the mostly empty Dillo, sucking on a glass of club soda I'd had the barkeep put about half an entire lime into to give his stuff some taste. It didn't help much. Even though I wasn't drinking, I was getting philosophical about the only thing that keeps me going is the music. I do love the music. Kenny, Cotter, and Peach were on the row stage tuning up. Cotter and Kenny took their shaggy heads to a quick riff on Cotter's Fender bass. Peach's lank mohawk sort of slumped over to the side. None of us felt in terrific shape. Nobody sat behind Bobby T's traps, not yet. I'd seen Bobby before lunch. He was still mostly out of it, drifting along on the painkillers. Tomorrow, whatever happened tonight, I'd stuff him in the car with the rest and we'd head out to points hideously beyond Midland and Odessa, but there was still tonight. "You are the manager?" I looked up. "Rusty McClanahan," I said. "I spoke to you last night." He was tall, thin, dressed in nondescript work clothes that could have come off the sale rack at JCPenney's. I noticed his hands and fingers. He didn't have the ground-in black telltales of an oil patch roughneck, but he did have rough skin and calluses on his fingers. Obviously, he'd done some real work in his life. His eyes were close-set and dark, hair close-cropped and the same color as the eyes, black, like it was ground in. "Still say you can drum?" He nodded. The other guys had seen the man come in. I'd already warned them over a black coffee breakfast. Naturally, they were skeptical. Kenny and Cotter put their guitars down on the wire stands. Peach stepped out from behind his Yamaha keyboard. They came over and stared at the stranger. He didn't seem to be too worried. He just looked back at them. I introduced the three of them to the stranger. He nodded at each name. "So, you got a name?" said Kenny to the stranger. He seemed to hesitate. "You can call me Ringo," he said. "Give me a fucking break," said Peach, not exactly under his breath. "Ringo?" said Cotter. "It's not really my name," said the stranger. "It is the name of someone I've always admired." "The outlaw or the beetle?" said Kenny. "Why, the musician, of course," came the imperturbable answer. "What a crock," said Peach. "I knew my keyboardist was not in a good mood today." "Okay," I said to the stranger. "I've already talked to the guys. We've got 2 sets to play here tonight. We're ready to see what you can do. Do good enough and you're on for the night. That's all I can promise." "That's fine," said the stranger. "I'll be leaving after the performance. The timing should be adequate." The members of Scorched Earth exchanged glances. "Let's do it," said Peach. "Boogie," said Cotter. "Rock and roll," said Kenny, ironically. The stranger got up on the stage with them. I couldn't quite bring myself to call him Ringo yet. He gingerly settled himself on Bobby T's seat, adjusting it a little lower. He picked up the sticks and tentatively wrapped the snares, tickled the cymbals, he thumped the bass. "So far, so good." "You want anything in particular?" said Kenny. "Whatever," said the stranger. "I can follow." He did. It was a terrific set. Too bad nobody was around except me and the barkeep. After a while, he even stopped polishing glasses. The guys tried a little of everything. Peggy Sue, Inagata Davida, Purple Haze, Travelin' Band, even, for God's sake, Wipeout. The stranger kept up, more than kept up. I've heard good. He was better. I've heard guys like Krupa and Buddy Rich. I've seen them in live performances that outclass their albums by 200%. I've seen the rock drummers. Hell, I've even worked with some of them. Back when John Bonham and Earl Palmer, Ginger Baker, and Stuart Copeland, even the other Ringo, Starr, that is. I've always thought Starkey was underrated. The guy was technically as good. He was fabulous. But there was something wrong that I couldn't quite put a finger on. The music was terrific for a band using a new drummer, but there was still something slightly odd. What the hell was it? I finally decided maybe it was the stranger was in a different and stranger league than the rest of the band. Nothing fatal, no mistakes, nothing like that. And what the hell? We had a contract to fill. Okay, I finally said, standing up and waving them all to quiet down at the end of Louie Louie. You got a drummer for tonight, I said to the guys. You got a gig, I said to the stranger. He looked like he wanted to smile, but he didn't. I don't know, Rusty, said Peach. It's not quite coming together. For tonight, I said. It's close enough for rock and roll. Thank you, said the stranger. I'd ask the manager of the Dillo Patch for some 2x4s and chicken wire to screen off the stage. Or, if not that, at least a big bouncer. He promised. They always promise, but nothing was erected by showtime, so along with everything else, I had that to worry about during the performance. Tonight, at least, the violence was limited to the dance floor. I was more than a little relieved that nothing got onto the stage from the rest of the room other than some saliva and spattered blood. The guys played their fucking hearts out. So did the stranger, who called himself Ringo. But there were still those odd rhythms in his drum work that I didn't think were anything as simple as just a lack of talent or coordination or anything like that. It was more like the stranger functioned in some kind of slightly different time zone. Forget roots rock, then. Maybe just go ahead and call what the group was doing tonight new music. Not atonal, not antitonal, just different, new. The drummer kept skirting what Kenny was doing with his lead, sometimes barely lagging, sometimes slightly anticipating, other times just drumming along in that barely different timeline. There was something about this that reminded me of something Bobby T. had said. I couldn't remember exactly what. No matter. At the end of the second set, the audience really did want an encore. Some of them had been listening. I was amazed. And Scorched Earth performed the hottest medley of moldy oldies and the coolest, sharpest Wisconsin death trap I'd ever heard. Wow, yeah, for 12 minutes. It took 20 years off me. Somebody in the crowd finally did get around to hurling an empty bottle, but it was half-hearted, and it was after the encore. The band had already trooped off the riser. The bottle just bounced off the far wall and lay on the ratty carpet behind the stage. The guys and I shared a triumphant round of Lone Star. The owner loved us, I said. Damned if he didn't pay every cent he owed No running poor mouth. I paused dramatically. He even wants us to stay another week. They all looked at each other. Kenny, Cotter, and Peach looked at the stranger. I can't, he said. I will be leaving. It's good money, I said. He nodded. I don't need the money. He handed back the 20s I'd just given him. You mean it? Said Peach. You're really taking off? He seemed to be 100% converted to the side of the stranger now. I mean it, he said. I'm sorry. We're all sorry, too, I said. He looked straight at me. I mean it, he repeated. So do we. I love the music, he said to us all. Directly to me, he said, keep watching the stars. And that was that. Later on that night, an hour after the stranger had reluctantly relinquished Bobby T's sticks and left us, I dropped off the guys to celebrate back in the room at the Motel 6 and headed out towards the outskirts of town. I climbed the same low hill I'd scaled the night before and sat down to watch the stars. I remembered what it was Bobby T had said that had been nagging at my memory. One time, Bobby T said that the reason drum machines were simply no good for any music with soul was that they were just that, soulless. The rhythm, Bobby T told me, had to come from the blood, the heart, from life itself. It was the beat of the human heart, the rhythm that clocked us all. It came to me, different rhythms, different life. The stranger couldn't stay because he had somewhere else to go. Fair enough. But he loved the music. I stayed there on that cold hill another hour under the twinkling stars. The sky turned slowly and the meteors fell. I kept counting the falling stars until finally I saw one that went against the grain of every other. It was on its way back up. So long, Ringo, I said. We conclude with a poem, also from the October 1987 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Frog Prince by Jane Yolen. It is so hard these days to find a proper prince. The world is dappled with pretenders, as spotty with them as an adolescent skin. I have three daughters. I have three wedding portions, waiting, waiting for the marriage offer. A kingdom is but a small return for 15 years of tending these hothouse plants. Can one read the heart? Can one judge the mind? Can one guess the future from a handshake by a well, from a dinner conversation, from a single night in bed? Yet my first wants to marry a drummer in a rock band. My second, a man who works with cars. What next, I ask you? A grocer's lad? A stable boy? An enchanted frog? This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.